Thank you guys for having me. Thank you, Anton, for inviting me. Thank you, Boris, for inviting me. It's really been a pleasure to spend the last couple of days here and thinking about these ideas. And my talk actually doesn't have a title. I needed to have a title, so I was like, what's the title? Forget Fedorov. Okay, fine. But I encountered Fedorov and Cosmism first when I was working on a project called The Last Pictures. And it was a project where I had done a lot of work around satellites and thinking about space and this kind of thing. One of the things I realized was that certain kinds of satellites, especially communication satellites, when you put them in orbit, they're actually so far away from Earth that when they power down, they just kind of keep going around the Earth forever and ever and ever, literally. And so I started imagining this future planet where the humans were all gone, but there was a ring of dead spaceships from an ancient alien civilization that had become a permanent part of this planet, right? And so I was trying to think through an artwork that would go, how would you turn one of these future monuments to the ruins of modernity in space? How could you make an kind of aesthetic / ethical gesture out of that? And so I was thinking a lot about spaceflight and a lot of the mythology around spaceflight. And in the US context, the mythology of spaceflight is the mythology of the frontier, right? What do? You go on the moon, you plant a flag, you do some mining on an asteroid, right? It's Nevada all over again. And I was trying to think about space in a really different way than that. And that's how I encountered Cosmism, where the relationship to outer space is much more complicated because space is a place where the particles of your ancestors exist. So you have to fly to space and collect the particles of your ancestors to bring them back to Earth so that you can resurrect them. And then once you've resurrected everybody, you have to have places for people to live. And so you have to like have space flights so they can live on other planets and things like that. This is a very un-American way of thinking about space. And it ended up being very helpful to me. I want to talk a little bit about some ideas from Fedorov that I think are maybe helpful, maybe not helpful. This is going to be a very basic overview. I'm going to repeat a lot of things that everybody has been saying for the last couple of days. And, you know, I just know there's some new faces in here and stuff like that. So I'm going to make it a very general introduction. The other caveat that I have to say is I'm not an academic. I'm not a historian. I'm not somebody who gets, you know, I don't do this for a living. I can read stuff and I can say, this is what I think about it. And that's what you're going to hear. So take everything I say with a huge grain of salt because I have my own particular readings of things. So as I kind of alluded to before, like there's, as far as I understand it, there's really two big engineering projects that Fedorov is proposing. One is a massive geoengineering project that takes place at the scale of the planet and then ultimately at the scale of the cosmos. So Fedorov wants to, you know, completely engineer the surface of the Earth and the planet and the cosmos in the surface of the humans. That's one thing he wants to do. The second thing he wants to do is, as many people again have mentioned before, is resurrect everybody who's ever lived, right? So bring the dead to life is the kind of second part of this project. And so there's a kind of spatial engineering, right? You're engineering geography and the cosmos on one hand, and there's a kind of corollary to that, which is on the other axis, there's an engineering of time, right? So why are these two projects so important? Well, they're actually symptoms or they're ways to alleviate actually a much deeper problem. And this much deeper problem is actually the thing that he's getting at. And that is the kind of alleviation of alienation. And I'm using that, and I don't mean it exactly in a Marxian term, I'm just gonna use that word alienation. And what he means by that is that he believes that we as humans live in a state of alienation, and it's a state of alienation that is characterized by many, many different things. Thereby unfriendliness and like unbrotherliness from people to people, but also by things like dualisms, by mediations, by representations, so, you know, ideas like the distinction between a subject and an object, between a mind and a body, between nature and culture, divisions of labor themselves within human societies, and even the distinction between life and death are all symptomatic and productive of this kind of alienation that characterizes human existence at the moment. So this question of alienation is both an ethical problem as well as a metaphysical problem. And the metaphysical part of it emerges from epistemology itself, you know, in things like mind-body distinctions, subject-object distinctions, and that sort of thing. So the part of the problem for him is the idea that we can speak about things as if we're not a part of them. We can talk about the world as if it were something out there that also we are not a part of. He wants to overcome that. And this is where these two projects come in, this geoengineering project and this resurrecting the dead project. These projects are meant to abolish that alienation and abolish that again on a kind of horizontal axis and a vertical axis. If you think about the vertical axis as being time and the horizontal axis as kind of being space. And so the reason why these projects are crucial to the overcoming of alienation is because alienation has to be overcome through practice, not through theory. So on that spatial axis, on the geoengineering axis, what that practice means is that we have to adopt a kind of attitude that says basically that nature does not exist, or that there is no such thing as nature as being distinct from the humans. And if there's no nature, then there's only nature as produced by the humans. And so that being the case, the humans should not feel nostalgic or sentimental about nature at all. Nature should be guided, controlled, and it should be put in the service of overcoming this alienation. And through the practice of sculpting the world and through the and the cosmos itself, we're going to find this practical solution to alienation, because we will no longer be able to think of ourselves as being distinct from the world and through the cosmos. And so that is where, that's how this geoengineering project becomes a solution to this one sense of this alienation. And you see kind of some echoes of this in stupid versions of like Anthropocene kind of theory, like the idea that humans basically kind of have their impact everywhere on Earth and we should kind of just get on with it. But the more radical idea I think that's in the Fyodorov is this question of time, the idea that you can apply this this geoengineering idea to temporality, that you can have it on this vertical axis as well. So he wants to not only to kind of collapse the distinction between nature and culture, he wants to collapse the distinction between the past, the present, and the future in this great project of temporal engineering. And this is where I think maybe we have something to learn from, to also recapitulate some of the beautiful things that Arseny said. So this project is, of course, kind of crystallized in the resurrection of the dead. He says, death can be called real only when all means of restoring life, at least all those that exist in nature and have been discovered by the human race, have been tried and have failed. So what he means by that is that for Fyodorov, the dead aren't actually dead. He has a much stranger take than that, which is that because we don't know whether or not we can resurrect the dead, we don't know whether the dead still have the possibility of life. And if we can raise the dead at some point in the future, then that means that death is not final. And if death isn't final, then the dead aren't actually dead, right? So this idea of the dead not actually being dead is central to his kind of conception of history and his conception of time. And I think that this has huge implications for us, those of us who think about time as an arrow that goes from the past to the future. For Fyodorov, the appropriation of time is our responsibility, and we have to set it going in a different direction. It has to go in both directions at the same time, or more accurately, to stop it altogether. And Arseny had a beautiful metaphor for this. I think he called it the arrow of time eating its own tail, is the notion of history that he wants to inaugurate. So of course, this is coming out of a 19th century context when progress is kind of a meta-narrative of the 19th century, one that he's very critical of. And he's very critical of the meta-narrative of progress precisely because it really underlines that distinction between the present and the past. And he said the idea of progress puts the people living in the present in judgment of the past. It's a very chronocentric notion of time or something like that. Basically, the idea of progress is it always puts you in this position where you're imagining yourselves as being superior to the people that came before you. And for him, that was a profoundly unhumanistic attitude to have. So part of this is a kind of philosophical question, but of course there is this practical question as well. So we have to take responsibility for this engineering, this temporal axis of the past, present, and the future. We have to, and as a part of that, we have to develop an ethical relationship to the engineering of time. If we are responsible for time, and if the dead are not dead, then allowing the ancestors to remain dead and in their graves, or as particles scattered throughout the universe, would be the same thing as seeing our families and friends wounded and not calling an ambulance. Right? So there's a really, he's asking us to think about the ethics of time in this really different way than I think what we're used to. So this is obviously a very different conception of time than a kind of classical Enlightenment notion of time. It's also a very different notion of time than a classically Abrahamic notion of time that you might find in Judaism or Christianity or Islamic theology. Time is not an arrow. It's a landscape for him. The time is a landscape. And it is... And through this landscape, we are connected through to distant galaxies, but we're also connected across time to generations of people who've died in the past and who will be resurrected in the future. So this is a conception of time wherein the past can be the future can be the past, and where we are really responsible for the ethical stewardship of temporality. Now, the kind of endgame of this is that this full realization of the Fedorovian project, the abolition of this alienation, would be, I think, the end of time and space, actually. Space would be fully connected and managed through these forms of kinship. There would be no outside to the universe. There would be no frontiers. And similarly, this idea... assumes a kind of end of time where the past, the present, and the future all exist simultaneously, and everybody who's ever lived is immortal. And this is what he means by this common task. And he ends the text that I have on the common task with the following quote: "For the vast intellect able to encompass in one formula the motions of both the largest celestial bodies in the universe and the tiniest atoms, nothing would remain unknown. The future as well as the past would be accessible to him. The collective mind of all humans working for many generations together would, of course, be vast enough that all that is needed is concord, multi-unity." Right? So he's talking about this incredible vastness and this very deep connection to things. So what do we have to learn from this? I'm not sure, actually. One of the things that I think doesn't get emphasized enough, but for me, it's just really overwhelming when you read this, is that this whole cosmology is really premised on a particular reading of the Bible. And this whole thing is like about Jesus, and it assumes lots and lots of different Christian premises. Now, the whole cosmology assumes, I think, that God created the universe for men. It assumes also that the Bible is infallible. And it also assumes the idea that the Bible is actually a blueprint that the humans should follow, and that our task is to create the kingdom of heaven on earth, right? So the Bible is not an allegory. It's something that's a blueprint for a universe that we need to create, in which we have dominion over everything, and immortality is not just a kind of Christian, either metaphysical thing or a metaphorical thing, but we actually have to make this immortal kingdom of heaven here on earth. Now, this project and these ideas, then if they're kind of given to the humans by God, then that comes with a kind of transcendental guarantee underlying it, right? The kind of transcendental guarantee that if you follow the instructions, you're not going to fuck up the universe, right? Because God says this is what you need to do. But now, if you take this transcendental guarantee away, you remove that benevolent God guiding the human actions, things go very, very wrong very quickly. I mean, the raising of the dead can easily turn into a kind of zombie apocalypse, and the geoengineering of the earth can easily turn into some kind of crazy idea about, like, oh, maybe we should, like, blot out the atmosphere or something like that to stop global warming. Just, you know, unbelievably hubristic kind of ideas can emerge from this. Having said that, I do think it's right that we can probably not, we need to stop thinking about nature as something being outside of ourselves. I think it's a very good idea. I just think that we should be far less cavalier about it than Fedorov is suggesting. Now, on this question of this temporal engineering, this is something that I think we actually can genuinely learn from. He gives us the opportunity, I think, with this cosmology to think about the ethics and politics of time-bending technologies. And over the last, you know, couple of centuries, we could even describe the last couple of centuries as being a kind of age in which humans have learned how to sculpt time in previously unimaginable ways. On one hand, we're making greater and greater interventions into the geologic time scales of the Earth, whether that's by doing things like making radioactive waste that's poisonous for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, or making dead spaceships that just circle the Earth forever, or making alterations to the climate, making alterations to the pH levels of the ocean, and so on and so forth. There already is this kind of geoengineering project that's in place. On the other hand, we also, to kind of go from the geologic to in the opposite direction, we've seen other forms of new masteries over time. In the 19th and 20th centuries, we saw what Marx famously called these annihilation of space with time through things like transportation technologies, communications technologies, you know, making the Earth a lot easier to get around, reducing the, you know, practical distance between places on the Earth's surface. That's a time-bending technology as well. And those are time-bending technologies that we might characterize, say, are characteristic of the 19th and 20th century. In the 21st century, we're developing a whole new era of time-bending technologies. And that has to do with the ability to store large amounts of data, perform data analytics, and the advent of new forms of predictive technologies. I'll tell you a story. A few years ago, I was at a party, and there was a very famous cryptographer there, this guy named Dan Bernstein, who's written a lot of the very basic primitives that are used in encryption. And I asked him what he was doing, what he was working on, and he said that he was working on post-quantum cryptography. In other words, he was trying to develop encryption systems for a kind of theoretical computer that might exist in the future called a quantum computer. It might, you know, in computer science, the idea is there it might be possible to build something like called a quantum computer that works very differently than the way computers do now. And one of the things that these computers would be able to do is break encryption very, very easily. So Dan was working on a project to try to build encryption for these kind of post-quantum computers, and he wanted to implement it now. And I was saying, well, why are you working on a project to build tools to defeat a kind of theoretical computer that doesn't even actually exist, and nobody knows whether it actually even can exist, and you want to deploy them today? And he basically said that because we're living in a world where the likes of Amazon and Google and Facebook and the NSA are able to kind of indefinitely store every email, every search term, every like and every tweet and every direct message, that we have to build tools for the present that protect us from the future, right? And I don't think that we should resurrect the dead, actually. But I do think that we need to start developing some very different relationships to time. That we need to develop an ethical relationship to time that can account for things like nuclear waste. Nuclear waste, which has already created spaces of death that will remain so for hundreds of thousands of years into the future. We need to have an ethics of time that can help us think about the chemical composition of the atmosphere, the evolution of other life forms, plants, and to the oceans and to the wetlands. But we also need to think about an ethical relationship to the little particles of ourselves that exist on cloud computing platforms, that exists on social media, in credit reports, in demographic profiles. We need to think about time differently so that the future does not become the enemy of the present. And I think that perhaps this involves a different way of thinking about what resurrection might be. By developing a more ethical relationship to the environment and to technology, can we resurrect ourselves from the accumulated data about us that the future will weaponize against us? Should we perhaps paradoxically demand the right to a digital death at the touch of a button to wipe our metadata signatures clean? On the other hand, can we resurrect the people who have not been born yet, but whose lives were nevertheless ended prematurely due to environmental devastation, hunger, racism, inequality? And perhaps that by learning from Fedorov to think about time as a landscape, one that we shape in the same way that we shape the Earth's surface, we can develop a framework for thinking about some of our most urgent crises. So thank you guys so much for having me.